Okay. I thoroughly enjoyed Mitch's story and some of the history. That was absolutely phenomenal. I've been interested off and on in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous myself. I think one of the reasons is my life has been saved by Alcoholics Anonymous. So it was almost natural for me to want to learn a little bit about it. And the fact that Mitchell was sponsored by Clarence Snyder is amazing. Clarence is one of the great characters of early AA. I've listened to a lot of Clarence's talks on tape, and one of my favorites is he gets sent to Dr. Bob out in Akron. He's drinking. He's on the skids. He's, you know, his family is just like a last-ditch effort to try to get him help. And they send him to Akron, Ohio, because there's a doctor out there that can fix drunks. This is what Clarence is saying on his tapes. So he gets out there, and he walks up to the door. And what it says on the door is Dr. Robert Holbrook Smith, proctologist. Okay, and he goes, well, here's something I haven't tried yet, you know, for quitting drinking. And the first thing he notices when he meets Dr. Bobby is he's got these really big hands, you know. So he's thinking, oh, man, I'm in trouble here. Certainly some great lessons are to be learned from early Alcoholics Anonymous and some of the first people. I'm looking at the cast of characters over on that display over there, the pictures of a lot of these early AAs, and that is a cast of characters, let me tell you. In this day, I got sober in the 80s, and back in the 80s, you couldn't shake a stick without hitting a rehab. I mean, rehabs were all over the place. The insurance companies were playing ball. And there was people in there, this is my 14th rehab, you know. And a lot of that stuff was going on. I got to tell you that insurance companies, for good or for bad, insurance companies have started to decide that it's not money well spent, you know, putting somebody through one of these things, unless it's a successful place. So a lot of the places that really weren't doing a good job, a lot of the places that didn't have your permanent recovery as a goal for you, a lot of the places that would just churn you through for the insurance money are gone. There was a period of time in like 1993 where over 600 rehabs went out of business in the United States. There was a lot of them in my area. So a lot of the ones that are still left are more successful and doing a better job than when I was coming around. My experience with rehab is I don't remember much from it, really. I do know that I went in there certainly with good intentions, and they had a lot of lectures and movies and things. And, you know, our book basically says self-knowledge is not enough. Self-knowledge will avail us nothing. So I can know as much as I can possibly know about Alcoholics Anonymous, about recovery, about the steps, about traditions, about everything. And just knowing it is not a sufficient defense against the first drink. I need to have an experience. So there are places out there these days that, as well as the education, they're really trying to offer experience also, recovery experience also. I know there's a place where I volunteer. I shouldn't say volunteer. I'm a lecturer there on recovery, off and on for the past 10 years. And when you're released from the place, you've got a set of amends cards. I mean, you're up to amends, and, you know, you're going out and you're making amends. And that's different. I got to tell you, it's a lot different than when I first came in. Really, the only thing they asked me to do in rehab was to write a life story. So I got a chance to do my twisted, psychotic autobiography. You know, being high on the Librium, you know, detoxing. You know, I found that like a couple of months ago, and it's like on four pages, and it's this tiny print. Unbelievable. Oh man, tiny print. That reminds me of a story. I gotta tell this story now. I'm gonna probably break seven traditions telling it, but I don't care. This is like mid 1970s, okay? And there was a lot of non-conference approved substances out there in the mid 70s that were available for people like me. I mean, alcohol was certainly always there, ever present. But every once in a while, there would be these other substances that would get me away from me. You know, it was always a mad dash away from the reality that is Chris. And I bought some LSD down at the park. You know, I'm going to have a good time. I don't know if anybody here has experience with LSD, but you take it, and then you have about an hour to get someplace safe, someplace conducive to, you know. Like, the last thing you want to be like is like Thanksgiving dinner at Aunt Millie's or something. You know, you want like a pretty safe place to be. So I take this LSD. I'm stopping at the liquor store, and then I'm heading home, and it's going to be blacklight posters, headphones, and Led Zeppelin, you know. So that was my plan. So I see this guy in front of me. He's a buddy of mine, and I think, I know what I'll do. I'm going to tap his bumper with my car because he doesn't see me. We used to do crazy things like that. So I give him a little bump. So I gave him a little bump. You know, and he's shocked. He turns around. He sees who it is, and we wave to each other, and he goes home, and I go home. I've got the headphones on, and, you know, listening to Zeppelin II, as was my wont, you know, with the hallucinogens. And all of a sudden, the phone rings. What happened was he went home, and he's got one of these, like, military-type fathers who reconnoiters the car every single time he comes home from driving. And he saw a little bit of black rubber on the back bumper from where I hit him. So he made him call the police and file an accident report. So all of a sudden, you know, I'm just more than a kid, and my mother starts banging on the wall. Chris, the police are on the phone. They want you down at the station now. Now, I'm like, oh no, because I'm seeing Disney World, you know, and it, in my room, and so I walk there because God forbid I'm going to drive, and I remember walking up to the police station. The lights are on. It's dark now. The doors are like 40 feet tall. And I remember walking into this police station, and you know, there's cops, and I mean, you can see their pores on their faces. And I walk in, and I remember going up to the desk. Oh, my name is Chris. There's an accident down there. You guys call me. And the guy, okay, get here. He hands me this. He goes, draw the intersection where this alleged action takes place. And he hands me a pencil. So I'm like, I'm drawing this thing. It's like the size of a postage stamp. I'm drawing this thing. And he's looking at me like, and he goes, no. And he grabs it away from me. And he rips it up. And he goes, here. And he starts drawing the intersection. And I'm like, no, it's not that big. I mean, I was almost ready to like, confess, you know, you got me. I'm tripping. But I'll tell you what, next day at school, I wanted to kill this kid, you know. Why'd you tell him it was me? Oh, it was just awful. Oh, it was awful. And that was back when it was working. You know what I mean? That's back when I was. I had no thought of moderating or giving up entirely at that period of time. Anyway, you know, the lessons that we can learn from the people in the past. We can make our own mistakes, or we can pay attention to the mistakes of others and try not to make them. You know, in Alcoholics Anonymous today, they used to say, there are no teachers in AA. That was another one of the lip-flapping oral tradition things that really is not true. There's nothing but teachers in AA today. Some will teach you what to do, and some will teach you what not to do. And, you know, the more experience you gain with recovery and the longer you're around, the fewer people there are out there that'll teach you what to do. And the more there are that'll teach you what not to do. Now, there's always a problem hanging on to old timers. It's really an issue. Look at it this way. If everybody that came into AA stayed, the same amount of people would be celebrating 23 years as you're getting celebrating 90 days. But you know that's not true. Pay attention at your home group next time and see how many people celebrate in the early part of their recovery and how few actually are celebrating 20, 30, 40 years. They're growing rarer and rarer. And somebody told me about a study that was done a long time ago and that they tried to find out where these old timers are going. You know, I don't believe they all drink. I think some of them do. But I think some of them, you know, drift away just because they can't take it anymore in the meetings. Hearing about the crap that gets shared in the meetings. They just can't take it anymore. They're years recovered. And they have to constantly hear about the insanity of somebody's life. And you know, if you frequent as many discussion meetings as I do, sometimes the same people are sharing the same thing year after year after year. Nothing is changing. And all they want to do is come in and lay their drama out. You know, somebody told me that if I shared my problems, I'd walk away with half of them. Well, if your math is correct on that, that means now I've got them, okay? And I don't appreciate it. Why don't you take your problems to your sponsor? That's what you're paying your sponsor for, you know? It was talked about earlier. We don't want to ruffle any feathers in Alcoholics Anonymous. We want people to like us. The alcoholic ego. God forbid somebody thinks poorly of us. But I'll tell you what. It's important. It's important for Alcoholics Anonymous to stay vital and to stay strong and to be the place where you're going to get exposed to recovery. I've got a very, very good friend whose mother was just tragically alcoholic. I'm not sure if he was alcoholic or not, but he drank with me. So that's kind of a clue. And he went through some hard times, and he went to a couple of AA meetings. And here's what he told me why he didn't stay. He goes, those people were more screwed up than me. I mean, you know, do we really want to appear more screwed up than the newcomer? I don't know. It says in our book that many of us set aside one meeting a week where a newcomer could share their problems, where we could find newcomers, where we could expose them to Alcoholics Anonymous and, you know, and help them out. Where it became we set aside 360 meetings a week in our area for the newcomer to share their problems. I just don't know how that happened. But again, one of the concepts that's in our writings that Bill Wilson would share quite often, especially from the podium, is the good is sometimes enemy of the best. So is it good to show up in an AA meeting, raise your hand, and share your problems? I guess it can help, you know, the best would be sharing your problems with a sponsor who can then help you apply the spiritual principles to ensure that those problems aren't regenerating on a regular basis. Okay? Is it good to pat somebody on the head and encourage them to keep coming? Yeah. But wouldn't it be better to actually try to engage in a conversation with them and bring them along with you on an experience with recovery? That's the best. You see, the good sometimes can be the enemy of the best. And, you know, what I'm kind of feeling with this weekend is I'm kind of feeling a challenge for all of us, not anyone in particular, but all of us, a challenge for us to do better when we go back to Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous or wherever we're from, and to just try to find ways to help alcoholics that are still suffering. Now, how I describe the still suffering alcoholic, I used to have the picture of the still suffering alcoholic as somebody who's drunk out of their minds or hungover out there. I believe we find the still suffering alcoholic in a lot of AA meetings. You know, I mean, if I go to a beginner's meeting every Monday night in my area, and the format of the meeting is this: for the first half hour, people with under 90 days share where they're at, what they're going through, any questions or any challenges they're having. And then for the second half of the meeting, people who have experience, people who have time, people who've been through the steps are able to share their experience on how they were able to get through that and what possibly might have been their solution for things that they relate to. And I get to see, in that meeting, I get to see the challenges that the new people are making. And the guys that I sponsor are very, very active in grabbing them after the meeting, shaking hands, getting their phone number, rather than saying, here's my phone number, I know you're not going to call, so I'm not worried about giving it out, you know. How often do we do that? But getting their phone number and trying to engage them to the point where they would be willing to start the steps. You know, whether it's the steps that will provide permanent recovery for you or not, I really think it's willingness coupled with action, coupled with the action. Again, you know, you don't get A, B's, and C's on how you do the steps. It's a pass-fail. And, you know, if you pass, you recover. If you fail, you continue in an unrecovered state. But the motivation and the actual determination to take action so often sometimes brings us the relief and the results that we're looking for from recovery. Now, where I stopped this morning, I was just touching on step five a little bit this morning. I covered very, very briefly a few of the parameters of step four as it's laid out in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what we have as a basic text now. I know that they did it different ways in the early days. I'm sure of it. I've even heard from some of the other historians that there was about 1,000 pages written on the four step by Bill and edited over and over and over and edited and edited and edited. And there are some existent existent papers on some of the earlier writings on the four step prior to being put in this book. But I think that they struggled. I think Bill Wilson struggled very, very much trying to put something together that everyone would agree on in this book. And I think that this really does cover the type of moral inventory that an alcoholic or someone with an addictive illness really needs to look at. I think it has it all in there. You know, are there things that we can do? Is there exercises and therapeutics and spiritual disciplines that we can get involved with after we get through the steps? Absolutely. That's what's really great about Alcoholics Anonymous. It's like spirituality 101. And we can take these things and build on them and really go to real lengths as far as our spiritual disciplines are concerned. But I think it's very, very important to do what's in this text. To mess with the directions is to mess with the promises. If instead of doing what it says in this book, you kind of alter it a little bit to fit your own unique personality, what you're doing is you're making it, you're taking away the assurance that you're going to get a specific promise. A lot of these action steps have promises after them. You know, 10th step promises are wonderful. So there's some 12 step promises. There's warning promises too. Like if you don't do this, you know, you're going to be on the balls of your ass. That's an actual quote from one of these chapters. I don't remember which one. But, you know, so being very specific and very following the method in here, I think is important, because so many people have done it and nobody's come back to me and said, "Chris, I did every single thing in this book and I'm still a mess. I'm still drinking. Nothing happened." I've never heard that. Never heard that. So again, I think following this as a guide to recovery is important. After I've done my inventory, I need to find someone to share it with. How I did it was I picked my sponsor, because it was my sponsor that was telling me to do a four step. Now, we're looking at middle of 1990. I'm telling you, in my area, you weren't told to use the big book as a guide in my area. And there was step meetings everywhere. So how did I do my four step? Because back then, you would ask a question, and these were the oral tradition guys, okay? They'd been around a million years, and this is a typical answer for them. You'd raise your hand in me and you say, "Geez, I'm confused about this four step. I'd like to know how to do a four step." And one of the old timers would answer, they'd go, "Kid, you do a four step with a pencil." Thanks for the help. You know, I learned later that the only reason you would give an answer like that is because you've never done one yourself. But, you know, you've got like 15 years. You're not going to be admitting that all too soon. But, I mean, you know, my sponsor gave me no direction. He said, "Chris, just do a four step. Just do a four step. Just do it." So my first one was I got a 12 and 12 out. And I don't know about anybody else. There's some great information in the 12 and 12 on step four about the seven deadly sins and a lot of other things. Very, very acute perception about the alcoholic mentality. You know, no one understood the alcoholic mental processes better than Bill Wilson. Nobody. But he wasn't writing the 12 and 12 as an instruction to go through the steps. But it's hard to know that because it's called the 12 steps and 12 traditions. So how do you do a four step? You go to the step book, and that's what I did. And I wrote this convoluted four step. Here's basically what it was. It was part personal history, part the dirty little things that I did that I'd never admitted to anybody, and character traits that I had. Like, I noticed about myself that I would be resentful toward you for something that I possessed myself. So like if I was resentful for you for being selfish, I knew that I had selfishness in myself. So it was like a pattern that I had recognized. So I wrote down these patterns. And I hid it underneath the car of my trunk, in my trunk, you know, because in case anybody would find it. Because, you know, we talked to Peter and talked about attachment. I was so attached to what people would think. I really thought that it was like Planet Chris, and you were all satellites orbiting around my, you know, my sphere, and you were all very much involved in like what I thought and what I did. And I mean, you know, it was just like crazy. So I was always attached to what, you know, what people would think, and what is he going to think of me when I read this? But, you know, I had some faith that this is something that would help me get better. And I remember going to a park with him and reading this thing. Now, it wasn't a fifth step based on the instructions out of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. So I didn't get the Alcoholics Anonymous promises. But I got the promises of, you know, a confessional, which is basically what the four step was. But I started to feel a little bit better about myself. It started to take a little bit of weight off my shoulders. Up until the time I shared this stuff with my sponsor, I really thought I was a scumbag. I mean, I had done 15 years worth of uninterrupted, selfish, tragic behavior, you know, just raping and robbing and pillaging across, you know, just me, mine, you know. And if you do that for 15 years, you're going to have a warped sense of self. You're going to have, your self-esteem is going to be a little bit damaged because you're going to know you're a scumbag. I'm a scumbag. So I read this thing, and at the end of it, here's what he says. Phil goes to me, Chris, he goes, I believe that you were an alcoholic from the get-go. I'm one of the guys who believes that you were born an alcoholic. And he goes, here you were. You were like a campfire with the embers, you know, the embers that were just sitting there smoldering. And once you took a drink, it was like throwing gasoline on that campfire. All of a sudden, it flared up and it burnt everybody, you included, and everybody around you. That's how I picture your alcoholism. And what he was kind of saying to me was that I had a condition, you know, whether it's a disease, I'm not going to get involved in that debate, but it certainly was an illness. It certainly was a condition, a malady, this alcoholism that I had. And I started to feel like, you know, yeah, maybe this isn't 100% my fault. You know, maybe I was caught up in something that was a little bit bigger than me. And I started to give myself a little bit of a break. And that's the first time I felt like I could re-enter society, or I was a part of society again. You know, because for so many years I thought I was a scumbag. Not a run-of-the-mill scumbag. I was special. I had special attributes. You know, I wasn't just any scumbag. But I was definitely a scumbag. But I was a special scumbag. That's how I thought about myself. I was wondering why I couldn't get any dates, you know. Anyway, so I did this fifth step, and it says in this book, the instructions to this book is to go home where you can be quiet for an hour and really review all of the steps that you've taken up to now and ask yourself, is it complete? Have you missed anything? Bill likes to talk about it as an arch and the architectural way he likes to describe it. Have you skimped on the mortar? You know, you're putting all the blocks together right. Because if you've held anything back on the fourth step or the fifth step, if you haven't been thorough, what you're doing is you're sabotaging the spiritual experience. You're sabotaging the recovery experience. I can't tell you how many people have relapsed who've done a lot of this, a lot of these steps with the guys I work with or around the meetings I go to or me, who held back on something on the fourth or the fifth step, who just didn't want to share it. What it was a corrosive thread that they allowed to be put into the fabric of their recovery. And until that's dealt with, it can be fatal. You know, it really can be fatal. Some of these things that we don't address, there are no small issues with the fourth and the fifth step. They're only fatal ones if we allow them to remain hidden under the rock. Now, there may be some things that there's the statute of limitations, you know, and you're kind of being guided by some people or by your inner conscience to, you know, is it really a good thing if I go to jail for 5 years or whatever? It gives us some leeway in the fifth step. I think it gives us leeway to do the fifth step with a priest, someone who has the ability to not be questioned under interrogation or be forced to testify. I mean, if that's the way, you just have to go. I think it's important to share this stuff. It's more important to share this stuff than to find reasons to not share it. However, I suggest to anybody that I'm working with that they share this material with a sponsor or someone with experience with the steps, someone who's been through the steps in Alcoholics Anonymous, because the feedback that you can get is a lot of times better. You get a lot better feedback from someone who's experienced this stuff. You know, if you share it with a priest, they may just say, well, go on, my son. You know, they're not going to say, I did that too. You know, they're not going to say, I did that too. You know, you puked on a cop. I did that. You're not going to get that. And I like the feedback. It talks about in some of our literature that there'll be a little give and take during the fifth step. And there was give and take when I did mine, my first one. My sponsor shared a couple of things that raised my eyebrows, I'll tell you. And I think he was doing that just to say, it's okay. Whatever you have to say, go ahead. Sometimes when I'm working with guys and I see that they're a little nervous and they're fumbling with their four step and they're getting ready to do the fifth step, I'll say, okay, you came here convincing yourself that you weren't going to share something with me. Let's start there. You know? And, how'd you know? Because I'm an alcoholic. That's how I know. So go ahead. Shared. It's fine. Whatever it is. There was one time, though, where this guy was working with me, and he did a four step. He had about 10 minutes on resentments. He had about 5 minutes on fears. Then he had 8 hours on sex inventory. I got to tell you, by the time he got done, I said, I got to call my sponsor. I go, Gary, get over here. I need you over here now. And he comes over and I go, tell him what you just told me. You know, I don't know what to do with this. I don't know what. Oh my God. So he did. He shared it with my sponsor too. And, you know, that was how I was guided to do it at that period of time. It was pretty bizarre. But a lot of times in this, you see, it's almost like you have a knapsack filled with rocks when you walk into your first fifth step. And as you share more and more and more, you're able to drop them out of the knapsack and you get lighter and lighter and lighter. And that's, it really does. It sets the stage for the next series of spiritual proposals that are in our book. Became willing to have God remove these defects of character. Now, Bill Wilson uses a lot of different terminologies for defects of character. He uses sins. He uses roadblocks. There's just a lot of ways that he puts it. He was kind of taught in English class that you don't use the same word over and over again. It makes you look stupid. So instead of saying defects again in the next paragraph, he'll use shortcomings. You know, I believe it's all the same thing. And if you get tied up in the semantics of it all, I think you lose sight of the true objective, which is we need to become willing to engage in the process, because we need to be willing and we need to participate, but we need to be willing to have God remove these things that are blocking us off from a relationship with God, a vital relationship with God, from a relationship with ourselves and from a relationship with our fellow man, the other people that we're inhabiting this planet with. We need to become willing to do that. I don't know any time where it's actually better for us to be conducive to the removal of these things than after a fifth step. You've just inventoried everything you can possibly think about the reasons why you failed at life. You've now shared all these things. You know, I mean, it's not something that you just can't wait to do, I think, when you're a newcomer. Oh boy, can I share every single thing I've ever done wrong, you know, with you later today? I can't wait. It's not something that I've seen people really, really looking forward to. Because it's an ego crusher. I did one of the fifth steps I did, it was a monster. I had about 106 resentments. I really got thorough. Really was motivated to get thorough during this one time. And it had to happen over the course of days. I think it took like a week or two to get this thing done, because it was about 15 hours worth of fifth step material. My ego was so smashed. I mean, I was so humbled that was I willing to have God remove these defects of character? Absolutely. I truly recognized them for what they were. They were blocking me off from the sunlight of the Spirit. and without the sunlight of the Spirit bearing down on my head. Great line in the 12 and 12. Who among us wishes to admit complete defeat? Glass in hand, we've warped ourselves to such a condition that only an act of divine providence can restore us. You know what divine providence is? God shining down out of the sky on your ass. That's what divine providence is. I mean, that's significant. So am I willing to have these things that are blocking me off from that divine providence removed? I hope so. I hope so, because the other option is not something I'm willing to tolerate. Because when I came in here, I was done. I wanted to be done so bad. I was done because alcohol was just destroying me. It was eating away my brain at the end. I mean, I could handle losing the family. I could handle 3 DWIs. I could handle waking up in jail not knowing why I'm there. You ever do that? Wake up in jail, not know why you're there? Could be any. And I found out one thing very important. Don't wake up your bunk mate and ask him. Okay? Sometimes they don't appreciate it. So, I mean, I was done. I was done. So I was willing. I was desperate. Am I ready to have God remove these defects of character that are blocking off from a successful life? Now, my ego, myself, is still grabbing on to anything it can grab onto at this period of time. Chris, you won't be that unique self that you are. You'll lose your uniqueness if God removes these character defects. You know, what if God removes lust first? You'll never get laid again. I mean, you know, all these things are going through my mind during these periods of time. You know, what if you have to wear a turban and sell flowers at the airport, Chris? What if that? I mean, I have to just trust in this process. And there's a lot of us in Alcoholics Anonymous today that will tell you, you know, you're not going to lose the good things about your nature. You're going to lose the bad things. The alcoholic ego, the alcoholic self that has been running your life into the ditch for all these years is the thing that's threatened. The self-destructive characteristics of your nature are what's being threatened. And your ego and yourself, they're going to fight to the end on this. So that's why we need a lot of encouragement. That's why we need Vital Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why we need good sponsorship. Because we need all the help we can get sometimes. And sometimes we have to pray like crazy for the willingness for some of this stuff. But I got to tell you, the other option is, well, they give us two options. Live life along spiritual lines or die an alcoholic death. I don't see any door number three there, you know. I don't know. I looked for door number three, like go to two AA meetings a week and, you know, not drink no matter what. And there was nothing behind that door, not for me. So live life along spiritual lines, die an alcoholic death. Gee. You know, it's funny. One of my favorite speakers tells this story. Anybody in here old enough to remember the Jack Benny Radio Hour? Okay. Jack Benny was absolutely classic for this one. He was so cheap, he still had the first nickel he ever made. You know, that was part of his personality that we loved so much. And he was doing this skit on the radio, and you hear him walking down the sidewalk, and all of a sudden, you hear a robber come up. And a robber goes, "Your money or your life?" You can hear this in the background. And all of a sudden, there's silence. And the silence goes on. All of a sudden, the studio audience kind of catches on a little bit, starts laughing. And finally, the robber goes, "Well?" And Jack Benny goes, I'm thinking. You know? And that's the joke. Well, a newcomer will come into Alcoholics Anonymous and, "Oh, God, I was drinking, I burnt the house down, crashed the car, lost the family, I just got out of detox." Oh. Okay, well, come on over to my house tonight. You know, we'll sit down with the book Alcoholics Anonymous and we'll get started on the steps because there's a recovery process that's, you know, you really need to get involved in recovery to remain separated from alcohol and for you to be able to put your life back together again. So can you make it over at 6? And then the silence starts. And finally you're like, well, I'm thinking, you know, I mean, that's how strong sometimes the ego is. That's how strong sometimes your self wants to maintain control over your life. I mean, you're dying, but go to somebody's house who worked the steps. You know, I don't know. I mean, we're crazy sometimes. So am I willing to have these defects of character removed? I'm about as willing as I can get. And you know that what? There's a prayer in this step that if you aren't completely willing, God, please help me to be willing for these removals. And then there's a prayer for God to take these character defects away. Now, I got to tell you, I'm a God guy, okay? Not only have I personally experienced the power of God in recovery, but I see it in the people that I work with. The power of God is alive today. Now, if we were the ones that were supposed to remove our defects of character, it would say, became willing to not engage in any of these character defects anymore and stopped engaging in these character defects. That's what the step would say. Now, you know, we want to hang on to the control. You know, we want to hang on to the control. I've heard a lot of people say that step 6 and step 7 is stopping doing what you shouldn't be doing. Now, let me tell you, if I could do that, I'd have done a better job by now. You know what I mean? How many of you have struggled with character defects and honestly wanted to not engage in those defects and yet engaged in them anyway? Yeah. Yeah, no kidding. All right? I believe that the desperation that we brought to God with our alcoholism, if we can summon up that same desperation and that same surrender with these character defects, I believe that the power of God can help us overcome these character defects. I do. I do. It's based on our willingness. It's based on our commitment. And do we have to participate? Absolutely. Again, God will not render us white as snow without our cooperation. How then do we participate in the removal of our character defects? How do we do that? I've found no better spiritual atmosphere, spiritual climate for the conducive removal of character defects than to become willing to make amends, direct amends, to those we had harmed because of these character defects, which shifts us again into a whole nother realm of spiritual possibilities. Am I willing to make amends to the people that I've harmed because of my character defects? It tells us in the book to make a list. It also tells us in the book that we've made a list when we did inventory. So anybody's sponsors that tell you to burn your fourth step after you do a fifth step, oops. hope you made a copy. What I find is column number 4 in the resentment inventory. Certainly some of the questions that we need to ask in the harms to others inventory. And I even send people back into the fear inventory to see if the manifestations of their fears have harmed anybody else for this list. And how I ask them to do it is how I was taught, which is amends cards. Start a stack of amends cards with the things that we've done to other people. Now, don't edit the 8th step because you're absolutely positive you're not going to make the amends in the 9th. I'm not even going to do a card on that, son of a bitch. It'll be a cold day in hell before I'll ever go back and make amends to him. Do it anyway. Make up the card anyway. Make up the card anyway. This is about freedom. This is about freedom. The difference between capturing everyone, every institution, every person that we have harmed on these eight-step cards that we're consciously aware of is very, very important, because it's going to be directly proportional to the amount of freedom that we get. And again, I've seen people leave a couple people off of their eight-step list and not do amends and get drunk. I worked with somebody who had 93 amends. He did 91 of them, and he did not do the other two, and he got drunk. I'm not saying that's going to be everybody's experience, but that was his experience. There were two things he just would not look at. He wouldn't look at. It was just too big. Again, how big is your God? How big is your God? Is your God big enough to help you through these really tough amends? With the people that I'm inspired by and the people that that I hang around with, there's some absolutely remarkable, remarkable eighth and ninth step stories that I hear from people. Absolutely unbelievable. I was with somebody last weekend who was sharing about the experience they had with their amends, and it was absolutely heartwarming to hear some of these stories about what happened. See, the ego, the self, is going to predict disaster with these amends. It's going to predict disaster. If I go to them, here's what they're going to do, and here's what's going to happen, and I'm going to get arrested or whatever. You know how we think. It's not only almost never like the way we picture it. It's never like the way we picture it. It just never is. The results are just never the way we think they're going to be. They're always at least a little different, if not completely different. So again, you want those defects of character removed that are blocking you off from God, your fellow man, decent relationships, decent jobs, decent being able to be an inspiration to your family and your friends and whatever dreams and ambitions you have. You want those character defects removed. The best spiritual climate for the removal of those character defects is steps 8 and 9. So you move into steps 8 and 9. Now, again, if it's the first time through the steps for somebody, I like to see the 8-step cards before they rush off headlong into these amends. Very often, they don't see the damage that can be done to another person. You know how selfish and self-seeking and self-centered we are sometimes. So I want to know what happened. I've usually got that from the 4-step, and I want to know what their intentions are for this amends. And we usually go over the approach. We usually go over how they're going to contact the individual, and we usually go over how best they're going to present this to the individual to make the amends. And obviously, amends are about setting right the wrong. On top of all else, we try to think, is there a way to set this right? It's also advisable to ask the person that we're making the amends to, or the institution that we're making the amends to, what will be the best way to set this right. But we kind of have to have an idea going into it. If we owe somebody money, that's easy. But these amends are vitally important for our freedom, for opening up our spirit completely to the sunlight beating down on us from God. Talk to anyone who has finished an amends list and then moved on to 10, 11, and 12. What their experience was finishing up that amends list. Ask anybody. This is not an experience you want to miss. Don't let your ego, don't let yourself block you off from experiencing this. Don't let fear get in the way. It talks about taking the bit in your teeth, even if you're afraid, taking the bit in your teeth and going for this with everything you have. because on the other side of it is a level of freedom that is just indescribable. It's really, really where recovery begins to happen with all of us. I'm going to finish up now. How about if we take a 10-minute break and we're back here at quarter to five, and Peter's going to come back up and join us.